You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You know, this is a news headline that Fox just ran. Iran just voted to increase military spending. Good God, man. We're like a guy, like, surrounded, right? We've got the chair in one hand, the whip in the other. We're surrounded by... We're surrounded by people. We're fighting them off. Iran watching North Korea going, damn it. That's supposed to be us, man. We're supposed to be getting all the love from the media, you know, poking the United States in the eye, blah, 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 blah. We're supposed to be, you know, hey, let me tell you, at some point, and just... The United States Navy, to me, is afraid. And the Navy's got to be, they got to man up, man. At some point, they got to blow an Iranian warship out of the water. There's a picture that ran in Military Times 2 weeks ago. And somebody who listens has a daughter that was on the ship that they ran. And I don't know if it was manned or unmanned that they ran by there. But at some point, like, in the picture, it's like, what do? Shoot or sound the collision alarm? Like, or you, how do you let them get that close? You know? If they fly or drive an attack profile, you're allowed to defend yourself in international waters. There's a protocol. You're supposed to get on the International Guard frequency and warn them, and then you have the right to defend yourself. Yay, Grant. Joining me mercifully, Grant Newsham. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Glad the comms are kind of working.
Yeah, well, you know, everything has a cost, my friend. Everything has a cost. I don't know why, but it didn't... It didn't register. I called on the Skype address. I did everything like I was supposed to. So I don't know what happened. But good to hear your voice. How's the future? How's Monday?
Oh, it's okay. It's just about finished here in Japan. But we're no missiles have gone anywhere as far as I can tell.
All right. I wanted to have you on. For those of you who've never heard Grant, you must be new to the program because, lo and behold, we had him on to make it smart about, the South China Sea and got to know him, through, him making us smart about that. And we've gone on to bigger and better things. The Chinese made a statement late last week saying that it's supposedly admonishing North Korea, if you move first against the United States, we will not support you. And then to the United States, if you move first, we will stop you. Now, I don't believe that I want to get your reaction to the statement and then react to this. I don't believe for a second that if North Korea acted preemptively and we went and smoked them, and then we're going to take over North Korea, that the Chinese would sit there and allow that to happen. So, give me your general reaction to the statement. Why'd they make it? What was the purpose? And if there was a shooting war, and it was, and it will go against the North Koreans, whether it's nuclear or not, what do you, would the Chinese look in your crystal ball? Would the Chinese just sit there and allow that? So there you go, Coach, teed up for you.
You know, it depends on how things play out, you know, like most things do. But I could, one certainly would expect the Chinese not to just sit back and watch events unfold. But one thing to keep in mind, I think, with the Chinese and with China as it's run by President Xi, who's got a colossal ego. He wants to be the next Mao and is kind of on his way to doing it. He's still got to kill about 50 million more people. But he's, you know, he's a very aggressive guy. But I've heard from Chinese people that I would listen to, is they don't really speak all that clearly for obvious reasons, but they get this feeling that he has not really thought through the outcome of whatever it is he's doing, his moves into the South China Sea, bullying India most recently, causing South Korea trouble. He's not, as they would say, much of a chess player. And the idea was, I think, from his perspective, that everyone would be so awed with the majesty of China that they would roll over. And when somebody stands up to him, I'm not convinced that he has actually thought this through in a very, as a systematic, long-term way. And he's sort of winging it. And I think this statement represents winging it. Here's the interesting part, I thought, is when you look at what was actually said, as much as you can figure it out from the translations, that one fairly asks, well, does this mean that if the missile does not hit U.S. territory, that America is not entitled in the Chinese position to do anything to North Korea? So suppose it just lands in offshore of Guam or lands offshore of San Diego. Does that mean America cannot respond or the Chinese won't allow it? What if it's an American vessel that's hit? What if it's a civilian vessel or maybe an American base somewhere overseas? That's not American territory. So it's not clear exactly what the Chinese are saying here. And it's one of these statements that on first glance it sounds straightforward, but when you think about it, it's a pretty vague, unclear statement as to exactly what China would do. And one might ask, well, does this mean that if the North Koreans attack Japan, attack one of our allies, that we're not allowed to attack North Korea because that's not American territory? And I think you can see some of the problems with this Chinese statement. And if I was recommending to General Mattis or Secretary Tillerson, I would tell him not to try and parse the Chinese words too deeply, but simply stand up for our position and be willing to stand up to the Chinese. And I would recommend doing what Kennedy did during the Cuban Missile Crisis, was let the Russians know that an attack on the United States from Cuba with a nuclear weapon would be considered an attack from the Soviet Union. And I think we may get to that point eventually. So that's just a few comments there.
Okay. Do you believe, are you at all familiar with the scenario for conventional conflict in North Korea, on the Korean Peninsula, Grant? And I know you've done intel work there in the Pacific. Are you familiar with the way we believe that, because that thing has been arrayed for how long? God, for 70 years close, right? And that's been, to say it's been wargamed a few times, would be an understatement. Are you familiar with how conventionally that thing is forecasted to play out?
Oh, I would be dated a bit, but like any Marine who's been out in that area, say an officer of a certain rank, at some point you've come across some talk about what goes on the peninsula, but I would not have any great inside information now, nor would I tell anyone.
Right.
But I think that most most people can kind of figure out in a general sense how things would probably be, one would hope they play out.
Talk to me about this notion. Do you believe that the Chinese would allow the peninsula to fall, to be unified under Western hands?
Well, I think at a minimum they wouldn't be happy about it, and they wouldn't be happy about it unifying under, say, a neutral government or one that is pro-American, pro-West. Of course, they would not be happy. Does that mean that they would launch everything and across the border to stop it? Maybe not. You know, once again, it depends on how things play out. You know, things could happen with such rapidity that they don't have a chance to get across, or that they could find that the war causes so much internal disruption to their economy that they've got other things to worry about besides what goes on in North Korea. It really depends, but it's certainly something to worry about, to one would rightly worry about, is the Chinese response, which is just as we would respond to, say, something kind of similar happening in Mexico. But I would expect the Chinese to be unhappy in any event. But how much of a response they would make probably depends on how it plays out, what other problems they've got domestically, what other problems they've got elsewhere. You could find that the economic effects of a war on Korea, say on foreign markets, just international trade, are such that it could really whap the Chinese, for want of a better word, but really just be a real blow to their capabilities, to their national strength, and also to them just psychologically. So one should certainly plan for them to get involved and try to make things as difficult as possible. But does that mean it should tie our hands with North Korea? I would like to think not.
Grant Newsham, my guest here. One of the other things that you've seen. Hold on, let me read you an email. Mac, I think if you read any unclassified assessment of the whatever event would happen on the peninsula, what you essentially have is stacked formations at the DMZ. Nobody is getting into the water from North Korea, at least in any sizable formation. I'm sure we all know that there'll be irregular forces attempting to do damage, and so that will have to be dealt with. But the big question is the conventional artillery and rockets that will be launched in both directions, the fact that many of those batteries are buried in mountains now, makes it problematic, and we know it's going to be sustained. But the infantry clash that would ensue in the vicinity of the DMZ would be one for the ages, because those things are scripted and have been thought about for a long, long time. It seems to me, and this is from my unclassified reading, because I've never really been to Korea. I've simply followed it since this dusted up, and I was curious about the conventional piece of this. Any conventional reading says there will be an incredible stalemate, and into that stalemate, the United States will assert its superiority in the skies initially, and then once that is done, as we've seen with other militaries. And I know the North Koreans are supposed to be more formidable, but nobody is close to us. We will slowly dismantle their anti-air defenses, and then we will set about destroying the rest of their military. We are fully capable. We will get more than a bloody nose, though. Know that, and it's sad, but the Korean civilians, especially the South Korean population, will pay heavily for this. I'm curious to know if Grant thinks that those basic pieces of the puzzle are off base. Are there any other major pieces in a conventional conflict that he would say you should think about? So, Grant, to you, my friend, I, you know what, again, I haven't been there. I was in Korea in 1984 and as and doing Team Spirit as a second lieutenant. And so I went back off the coast, and we didn't even put into Korea when I was on the USS Ranger in 1987. Have not been back there since. And so I was a second lieutenant. You know, I was worried about my platoon. So, but I think that assessment is from my own cursory reading starting last week about the conventional piece of this. I don't know how it goes another way, because the North Koreans are limited in terms of they're not doing Incheon, they're not going to sea in any in anything but a small rubber boat without it getting blown out of the water relatively quickly. Do you think that assessment is within the left and right lateral limit?
Oh, I think it's certainly in the ballpark. I don't even think it's in the far right field corner. Yeah. And that's a sensible sort of look at things. I particularly like the mention that we would get a bloody nose in this. You know, I've been around some things in the past where, and if I've ever seen the fix being in terms of predicting things, that perhaps did not take into account that we would get shot up pretty well if we get into sort of certainly anything serious on the ground. It's really part of the game. The geography is so different here compared to everywhere we've been lately. You might compare it to parts of eastern Afghanistan in places to get an idea of the hilliness, which is a tough business. A couple of things that may be worth considering is that, you know, I think it is accurate that we probably would be able to, hammer the North Koreans and really make it pretty tough for them to move around much. And we'd gradually knock off anything, but most of what they've got. But once again, you know, I think we see wars never turn out quite the way you expect. And I can't think of one that has. In the way they've been predicted. You just go back to, World War I, but just start with our first Gulf War. They always turn out differently. There's something that surprises us, and the predictions are always a bit wrong. And one thing I would consider is, what if we do, manage to hammer North Korea and do kind of dominate them, but what if they don't give up? You know, and suppose they've got, say, enough missiles that, say, can reach Tokyo, reach Japan. Once Japan starts taking any sort of hits, any sort of missiles, and if North Korean operatives in Japan go to work, that will complicate things immensely. It won't necessarily cause us to lose, but it would, I think it certainly politically be very difficult. And the economic disruption sort of in trade would be immense. If you want to see a stock market go down about 10,000 points in a day, it'd probably take just one round fired across the DMZ or on the peninsula. But I think what the gentleman described is certainly is plausible. Of course, predicting what China would do or could do is very difficult, but also poorly understood or predicted part, other than it'd be difficult, is the effect on the worldwide economy. And, you know, say it does plunge the U.S. and the world into a global recession, that tends to shape people's views of things, particularly these kinds of wars. And if, you know, what if the North Koreans just don't give up, they don't surrender, you can't find Kim and kill him, that suddenly you've got this thing that hasn't worked out, it hasn't been brought to conclusion the way people expected it would be, and that starts to affect America's image in the region. And I think that if we don't win whatever, if something does happen and we don't win it, that's not going to work to our advantage, I think. We're going to look inept, and it's going to cause a lot of disruption in terms of the American presence, American influence in the region, and I would suggest globally as well. So it's not just a military thing to consider, but there's an economic angle, political angle, psychological in terms of how the United States is viewed. It would be nice if we would win a war one of these days, but North Korea is a tricky place to do it. But once again, if you come down to the choice between really going for broke in North Korea or standing by to have the North Koreans slip one through and hit San Francisco, sometimes you've got some pretty bad choices and you do your best. But I thought the gentleman's assessment was a good one.
And then let me read you one more email. Interesting. Does Grant think that China could oust Kim if they so chose?
Probably in about an afternoon. Yeah, they could do it. Cut off oil and the game is over. They have the ability to strangle North Korea. And they never wanted to. I think actually they wouldn't mind it if North Korea did get decent missiles and started shooting them off at Japan, at the Americans even. I don't think they would mind that actually. But China does have the ability to turn off the spigot, and that would bring that regime, the Kim family regime, which is really an organized crime racket, that would bring it down just the way you can cut, the New York, you go after an organized crime gang by cutting off the money. They could do it. They just don't want to. With these recent sanctions that have been implemented passed at the United Nations, they haven't been implemented, and I don't think they ever will in any real way. You know, you have China now promising to put some real limits on what is exported from North Korea. Now, they've been saying all along that they don't have that ability, that they can't do it. And now they've agreed to do it. So the question you would ask is, well, were you lying then or are you lying now? And also it raises the question that about something we always hear is, I've heard it's on the U.S. government, I've heard it in the U.S. military, academia, etc., that, well, we can't be too harsh on China in the South China Sea because we need their help with North Korea. But China has been saying that they have no influence over North Korea, so why would we need to go easy on them in the South China Sea? But I don't understand why we haven't, but that's what an argument that you still hear. But China could bring North Korea to heel very quickly if they wanted to.
My guest this morning is Grant Newsham. He's he writes. You'll see his columns appear in Asia Times, and he's also he's a retired Marine colonel, intelligence type, and devoted much of his career to the Pacific Rim, and in particular those things that relative to Japan. So he's come on and very graciously as he has over the course of years. He's also he also does work for the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He's a senior researcher there. And I've got another email for you. Hey Mac, I think oftentimes, especially on the conventional side, we overestimate people. Our biggest problem relative to the conventional fight is making sure we have enough ass to do it. I don't think anybody needs to go very far to bump into the issues relative to aviation readiness. And how does that impact our ability to project power in a separate theater, given what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan?
You said it. It's a problem, and I think everybody knows that. Just even marine aviation has had some serious problems in recent times, to put it mildly. And the, you know, that's, you know, I think undeniable. But the point of the, I think a good point here is, can we do two things at once? We could find ourselves so bogged down, or just having, even if not bogged down, needing so many resources to go after North Korea that it leaves other places untouched or uncovered or not covered enough. The Middle East comes to mind. I think Iran would have some ideas of things to take opportunities of, and you could even have China as well. Say, throw its weight around in some other places, India, Southeast Asia, South China Sea, use the cover provided by the distraction of North Korea to push elsewhere. And this is, you know, I think is the an outcome of what I take to be underfunding, or I'd say what we've got and hasn't been spent as well as it should have been. For $600 billion, we should be able to buy a fair amount of defense. But I do say the military, I think our capabilities have sort of waned a bit in recent times, and I'm not sure we can do more than two things at once, or more than one thing at once, very well. And we're also, you've got some opponents for the first time in a long while, who really are not guys who wear turbans and loincloth. And that is something different. But the gentleman also mentioned that we do tend to underestimate or overestimate our opponents. But that may be better than underestimating them, and right. We should consider ourselves lucky when we do get a break. But we generally, it is surprising just how often what is predicted and what turns out to be the case in terms of how wars play out and how terms of enemies perform are all just so different than what even, I think, intelligent people think the case is going to be. But we do have a little empirical evidence with Koreans and also this kind of terrain, and it's, I would suggest, it's probably worth being erring on the side of caution, I would suggest.
All right. The I'm looking at a ranking of nations relative to defense done in 2015, so you're going to have to discount for that. India is the fifth most powerful military in the world. Their budget is $50 million a year. They have 1.3 million active duty frontline personnel. I would say active duty personnel. They have 6,500 tanks, 2,000 aircraft, and 15 submarines. China, $216 billion budget, 2.3 million on active duty, 9,000 tanks, 2,800 aircraft, and 67 submarines. I would be interested to see the Indians and the Chinese get it on a little bit and see what happened there. You want to make a prediction? Think the Indians acquit themselves well?
Yeah. You know, I think they would. Who would win, I don't know. But I think that what's going on with the Chinese and the Indians is another example, I think, of one. It's the it's kind of this Chinese aggression, this desire to take what other people have that academics and experts have been saying doesn't exist. You know, they've been saying this for years, though China doesn't have any interest in other people's territory. They've never been acquisitive in this regard. It's just always been nonsense. But you're seeing that the Chinese, they want what someone else has. If they can get this particular piece of terrain up in the northeast, what they have the potential to do is to cut off really the eastern, those two eastern provinces of India, basically isolate them. And it is it's key terrain. But I think they've also have not thought this out. I think Xi is not as smart as he's kind of adult in some respects. I think is that he hasn't thought this through. You know,
that.
you start a war with India, and this is one that's going to cause China some real problems just by virtue of. Being in a starting a war with another democracy, and even though there will be plenty of people on the U.S. side, particularly once again, in the commentariat who are willing to see the Chinese position, and the Chinese will claim they've been provoked, they had no choice, and there will be a sort of a hallelujah chorus on the U.S. side that is willing to agree with that. But there's also, these days, there's more people who've wised up, and even in Europe as well. I think that this would really hurt China's reputation, which, not that the Chinese would care all that much, but I think in this case they would. I think starting a war with India is very different than building some islands in the South China Sea. I think the Indians, you know, one often hears, well, they got clobbered in 1962. True enough. But 1962 was like a long time ago. Things are different. And I think the Indian military is still not, it's like most militaries, isn't really what it, you think it is on paper. And it's got, so it has some problems. It's certainly in terms of maintenance, its ability to operate. And it's got a Ministry of Defense, I think, which is trying to strangle the life out of the military, and that's the Indian bureaucracy for you. So the Indians have got some problems, but in terms of being willing to fight, I think they will. If you deal with Indian officers, and it's always fun, particularly older guys that actually had some involvement in the back in the 60s, with China, that they've always been very clear that they see themselves as still at war with China. And they also understand that there is nothing to be gained from caving in to the Chinese. And it's sort of refreshing to hear that. And I think that India would shoot back. And I don't think that Xi has expected anybody to push back against him, much less to shoot back. And I think the Indians just might. I suppose from a liberal arts perspective, it would be interesting to see how it played out. But I think in terms of the, certainly from an Indian perspective, that the potential of losing this particular geography is such that they would have to fight back. And they just might. And I'm not sure that China's thought that this would be the case. And Bhutan as well has actually basically told the Chinese that they're liars. And has sided with the Indians here. And I don't think China expected that, but both India and Bhutan are demonstrating how you deal with the Chinese. They appear to have the advantage of not having an Ivy League education.
I've got to take a break. When we come back, can you tell us a little bit about President Xi? Who is he? I don't know. Has he ever served in the military? Where does he come from? How did he rise? Could you tell us a little bit about that guy?
I'm sure I can exhaust my knowledge in about 15 seconds. But I'll give
you know more than the rest of us. I enjoy the way you give him the back of your hand. More of Aubrey Radio. Grant Newsham, a guest here on a Monday. Coming up next. Don't touch that dial. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure, We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Good morning. 8:18 on the Pacific coast of the United States of America. Continental United States, that would be to everybody. Yeah, if you're on the East Coast, it's 11:18. And if you're on the East Coast and you're a fat man, lunch just around the corner. Joining me from Japan, where he does a fair amount of work, is Grant Newsham. So, Grant, first of all, as always, enjoy having you on. Thanks for doing this, staying up late at night. What time is it in Japan? Are you in Tokyo?
Yeah, I'm up in Tokyo now. It's a little after.
I'm going to make a general statement, and I often describe Japan as one of the most racist places I've ever been. Is that a fair criticism? It's not even a criticism. It's just an observation. Island culture, they're one tribe. They're not very welcoming. And I'm not saying like black Japan, black. I'm just saying Japanese, non-Japanese. It's a pretty, in fact, when the Rodney King thing happened and the ambassador, Japan's ambassador to the United States, came out and criticized, you know, what happened, I thought, whoa, bro, wait till you go through the 50s and then maybe you can go through the 60s and then you can join us here, you know, in the 90s, but dial it back because your little island, you know, it hasn't even entertained civil rights as the melting pot knows it. So, as somebody who spent a lot of time there, I'd be curious about your comment on my observation.
Yeah, I would say not as badly as South Boston, but I don't think it's that bad, but I would suggest that anywhere on Earth you can find this stuff, and if you scratch the surface. The Japanese, I think, are no better or no worse than anyone else. In fact, probably in some respects, they're maybe even a little better, but like you described, they don't see their country as one that is a melting pot, and they don't really welcome any immigration in any large extent, but you do find that actually Westerners do get, at least superficially, get sort of preferential treatment and generally have a pretty good impression of the place, but Southeast Asians less so, obviously Koreans, then they will sometimes be treated a bit differently, but it's actually, I think, superficially at least, it's a pretty polite place to be. I think compared to, you really notice it if you live here a long time and go back to America. But you're right about the sort of the way that Koreans would be looked at askance somewhat, and once again, Southeast Asians differently. Chinese are considered kind of noisy and wild. You're not likely to notice this a whole lot if you come here. And even if you live here, you really have to get into the culture, speak really good Japanese, and hang out in certain places to recognize this. Otherwise, it comes across as a very polite place. But I don't see it as, any particularly bad. I would say when an ambassador criticizes the United States on these grounds, that would, of course, irk me. And that's when you would find, if you ask me that question right after I heard an ambassador criticizing America, then you'd get a little different
response. All right. Now, I don't want to get sidetracked. I also had an interesting experience. I'm a second lieutenant in Korea. We did Team Spirit. And I don't know what was going on in the world in 1985 in the spring, but we were constantly tied to the Air Contingency Battalion requirement. So we got off the island twice. We went to Korea both times, and we went back to the train at Camp Muchuk. And so somebody thought it would be a good idea to swap platoons between companies that were training with each other. So it was a very interesting experience. So my platoon, because I'm such a polished individual, or the rest of my lieutenant buddies were just rubes, I was chosen to go spend my time embedded in a South Korean company. So I was just another platoon. And the company commander was a captain by the name of Park. So I can't remember what we were doing. And I wound up standing there with his lieutenants and him talking, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he had he held it below, not like above or from the side, but the way that some people will do it, smoking a cigarette with their hands, fingers below the cigarette. He's smoking, and he says, using the N-word, he looks at me, and he says, Lieutenant McNamara, he said, do you believe, and he uses the N-word, are you equal? And I just looked at, and this is now, there must be like six of us standing there. So I looked at him and I said, the United States is founded on that concept. Do I believe it? I absolutely believe it. And I was shocked. And then he said many Koreans believe they're animals and they have tails. And he used the N-word a second time. And so I looked at him and I said, hey, sir, if you use that word in my presence one more time, I'm taking my platoon and I'll go back to my company. Okay? And he said, well, I do not mean to offend you. I'm just telling you. I said, I cannot help the ignorance of the Korean people. He didn't particularly care for that comment. And then he looked at me and said, you know, two American soldiers raped a Japanese, a Korean girl last year, and it is a very big deal here. And I said, well, so that's unfortunate. I said, who did the rest of the raping in your country last year? He looked at me and he said, you have a smart mouth on you, Lieutenant. I said, no, sir, I thought we were just talking about this, but were the other rapes done by Korean men? I assume they are. I said, is that a big deal in your country or just what Americans do? He said, I think this discussion is over. I said, all right, sir. But it was, I mean, it's, they don't, you know, black people in those cultures and Hispanics, I mean, it's just not, they're not melting pots. And just as Europe is having the same, my nephew, I don't know how we got into this rambling discussion about race, but, well, I actually do know because I did it. But he just came back from Germany. And I asked him, I said, hey, what is the German tie to Turks? Because they seem to have a very large German population. And I didn't know that. He said, well, after World War II, Germany needed laborers. And so they entered into a deal with Turkey to allow Turkish men into the country, and then they were allowed to bring their families. Now they want them to go home because they don't love Lederhosen. But they weren't accepted into the culture, so you have these Turkish ghettos that aren't German, even though the kids speak German, and it's a huge problem in Germany, as culture is, because the Germans don't see, you know, turban-wearing Turks with Lederhosen on. That's not the way the Lederhosen thing goes. And he said, I was really surprised at what a big race is in Germany. And because they don't see that as Germany. They see Germany as Germany with Germans with white, blonde, blue-eyed, soccer-playing Germans in their country. And so I just find it interesting, as you move around the world, we have this conception of what the world is. My experience with the Japanese is they were okay as long as you stayed in your lane. But if you wanted to go into the wrong bars that weren't tourist bars, if you wanted to go to different places in their culture, they did not care for that. And they were not afraid to let you know that you're not welcome here.
Yeah, so, I think, you know, you've got a point, and I could now, if I were to think, I could think of plenty of examples of that. My words, the way I tend to look at all of this, having been around Asia a bit, is that it's any criticism they would have of the United States is about as unfounded as you can possibly get. In terms of race relations and sort of the American experiment is infinitely better than just about any of these countries out here. I think Singapore, though that's only 5 million people, has really tried to get it right, not imperfectly, of course, but there's no grounds for Asians to criticize Americans on this particular topic, to my way of thinking. Yeah, every now and then, you know, in Japan, a taxi driver won't stop for me, and Or there's something, you know, you know what's going on. And you've described places where Western foreigners are not allowed in. That I could obviously talk at some length once the, depending on what time of day and how irked I was. But there's really no grounds for any Asian country to criticize America for its imperfections.
All right. Back to China. Here's another email for you. Mac, first of all, just make sure Grant knows how much we enjoy hearing him. Most of the talking idiots on TV don't have nearly his experience, and so it is absolutely refreshing. His frankness is also amusing. Please don't forget, as you talk about race around the world, to allow him to expand on President Xi. Lest I forget, thank you for the reminder. Who is this guy?
He's going to be the next Mao Zedong if things continue as they are. He's obviously the president of China, but he looks like a Chinese Winnie the Pooh. And there's actually cartoons in China that they get censored pretty quickly of, like, Winnie the Pooh with President Xi's head. And he looks like Winnie the Pooh physically, you know, short and pudgy like that. He's from his family was politically prominent going back a ways, and then they suffered during the Cultural Revolution and that turmoil. And Xi himself spent a good long while in the countryside, pretty much doing manual labor or such like. Not an ideal situation for him. But they eventually, as the sort of political winds changed, his family was rehabilitated and he came back and got decent education. Well, he got an education. I don't think he got a very good one. My recollection is he did the equivalent of majoring in sociology. It wasn't sociology, something wasn't that good. But nonetheless, by Chinese standards, he got an education. But what you've seen, and this is, I think, the important part, is he's a tough customer, and I would say a tough thug, as guys who are successful in the political world like this often are. I mean, he has successfully, so far, sort of concentrated power in himself, and that has seen since Mao. And he's done that by going after his rivals really successfully. And the excuse is an anti-corruption campaign, as you figure that every official in China is corrupt, that there's always something to go after them for. But he's really he's been very successful at this. And what's really impressive is a couple years ago, he actually got the head of the public security institution, who was considered untouchable, sort of the J. Edgar Hoover and then some.
Right.
And she brought him to heel. He's in jail now, did that successfully. He got rid of a fellow named Bo Xilai, who was another rival. But the corruption campaign that you hear about is really directed toward Xi's opponents. So he's successfully accumulated an awful lot of power. He's brought the PLA under control, and there's been a lot of jailing, suicides, with some help, charges against rivals in the military. So he's really, you got to hand it to him for that. But he's also motivated apparently by having seen the experience of the former Soviet Union. And the idea being that the Communist Party in Russia let things get out of hand. Xi does not intend to let things get out of hand, and does tend to sort of maintain power for himself and the Communist Party, though it's hard to distinguish the two. He seems to be the guy who was behind the move into the South China Sea, building the islands, asserting, really grabbing it, for all practical purposes. But he's doing all of these things, though, as in any place, he's created a lot of animosity amongst rival factions. And one never knows when the pendulum's going to swing back, or if it will, but it's always a possibility. And then the last thing that I touched on is that he's, some quarters, is considered kind of a rube, to use that word twice. And
I love that. Yeah. It's not a word you hear used often, and so I love it, especially when you're describing the president of China.
Why I've heard it said is that, you know, he's not all that well educated. Though I must say that considering how well our educated, well, your pedigree class has done for us, that I'm not sure that's a criticism. But he hasn't. I don't think he's a chess player, a guy who can really think through these things, the things that he's doing, and the potential response. And once somebody stands up to him and the economy really stumbles, and it is a house of cards, then he's got a problem, and the external distractions will only get him so far. So, and that is some criticism I have heard in Chinese quarters of him, and I think it's correct that he hasn't thought through the consequences of what the aggressive behavior he's got China doing, and this could cause him some real problems. And there was, as noted, there was a sense that well, everyone would just be so impressed with China that they would give up, and and that's not necessarily going to happen. And so he's had a good run. How long it will last, I'm not sure. I wouldn't dismiss him or dismiss his prospects, but I wouldn't, at the same time, I wouldn't say it's a given that he is going to be the next Mao as he wants to do. Things sometimes happen that are unexpected. And personally, his family is known to be as corrupt as every other family. When Bloomberg and the New York Times wrote some very good stories a few years ago, they really got leaned on by the Chinese government, and both of them have pretty much acquiesced. But you know, Xi himself, he's as dirty as all of them.
All right. The what are you working on in terms of what are you writing this week?
Well, I was asked to do something about a contingency on North Korea, trying to say something nobody else has said. What I'm thinking of getting at is, what would the effects be on Japan? How would Japan respond? What could Japan do to contribute to the Americans? So that's what I think I've going to get. I was asked to write something along those lines.
All right. All right. What could they do? I'll have to wait and read.
I'm still thinking about it. There's things they can do once the fire that their hair goes out. But they, you can find the JSDF could be very useful in providing support for us. As one of the other callers mentioned, if we get occupied in the, on the peninsula, there's a lot of things we would have trouble covering. And those are things the Japanese could do very nicely for us. I think Mr. Abe has set things up so that psychologically this idea is not as much of a shock to Japan writ large as it would have been just 5 years ago. So I'm thinking it through.
All right. The final question for you relative to Japan. Does this whole period of turmoil that has begun in the South China Sea, that will certainly move to the East China Sea, and this instability in Korea, will Japan rethink defense spending and begin to see things in Japan's defense budget that we haven't seen in a while?
I used to think so. I used to think the logic of it all would make things happen, but I don't think so. I think it's going to take a missile, probably one would do the trick, a missile landing in Tokyo or Osaka and killing people, or a Japanese ship getting sunk and Japanese sailors getting killed. I think it's going to take something like that to wake them up. You know, I think after 50 years of pathologic dependence on the Americans, it's hard to go out and get a job. And, you know, so I just don't see it happening until there is some disaster that befalls Japan. That's just my take. As I say, I've changed my mind on that within fairly recent times, because there are plenty of Japanese who understand what needs done. But I would almost compare it to us changing reforming Social Security. Well, there's a lot of people who understand what needs done, but for some reason, human beings just have a really hard time changing things like this. And, you know, they've gotten so comfortable getting the equivalent of $50 billion in free defense from the Americans every year that, you know, why would you go out and get a job if someone else is paying for it all?
I've got a kind of a human interest question for you here. Hey, Mac, does Grant like Japanese food? If so, what's his favorite dish? Grant, do you care for Japanese food? I imagine you must.
Yeah, I do. It tempura, if you ask me. You can go to these little fast food places, and for like $7, let's actually get a nice bowl of rice and tempura. Well, I've got a friend. This is, you know, I've actually found my mouth has taste has changed over the years.
Uh-oh.
And if I was given a choice between chocolate or potato chips, I'd have to think about it. I like salty stuff.
Right.
But a funny thing, I've got a friend, and he thinks that I like, since I'm an American, I must like high-class food. So he will invite me to French restaurants. And he has no idea that I would much rather be at the 700 yen tempura place. I like it. Like most Marines or anyone who's been here for a bit, that you really can't get to like it. It's a comfortable place to live. And I would find the politeness, even if it is superficial, well, that's okay. You know, it's once again, it's not South Boston, so it seems really nice by comparison. People seem polite, but no, I'm being mean. But,
I've got another email that kind of links something I did a week or two ago. Mac, I'd be curious to hear Grant's comment, knowing the Japanese culture as he does, about the audio interviews that you played 2 weeks ago about the survivors of Iwo Jima. I, like you, had never heard anything like that. In fact, I'm astounded, and I went back and I listened to them a second time. They are absolutely riveting. Does he have any experience with Japanese veterans and how the culture has treated them? It seems like such a tragedy that these brave soldiers who fought Marines on Iwo Jima came home and could never, ever speak about it. It sounds to me very much like Vietnam veterans and the way they got treated. One, to be a prisoner, which meant you surrendered, which was dishonorable. Two, the horror of living in those tunnels and fighting out of those tunnels. At the end, when they say that their tunnel was flooded and then fuel was on top of the water and the fuel was set on fire, it sounds incredible. I don't blame the Marines for doing it one bit. In fact, I would tell you that the improvisation and the low-tech nature of it has a bit of genius to it. But that kind of brutality, the world doesn't see very often. Does Grant run into any of that relative to veterans of World War II, in particular Iwo Jima? I'm curious. Grant, I don't know if you've seen the interviews, but if you haven't, I'll send you the links. But it's riveting. I've never heard a survivor of Iwo Jima on the Japanese side speak. I've read a couple things that have been attributed to people, but it was absolutely positively fascinating to listen to somebody for the first time talk about what their instructions were, how they fought, how they tried to help people at first, and then they would tell guys that were wounded, you have to leave, we can't spare the food, go kill somebody and die. Have you ever heard anything, and have you ever encountered Japanese veterans of World War II, in particular the Island Campaign?
Oh, boy, it's an interesting topic. It's one I'm interested in. We could probably do an entire show on it. Yes is the answer, and Iwo Jima in particular. I was the Marine attaché for a while in 2006-ish or so when they needed somebody. And we had some dealings with the Iwo Jima Survivors Association, but it was also as much the bereaved families associations with them.
Right.
And I actually met a couple of these guys, and you know, some spoke at some length. They both spoke a form of Japanese that I found barely intelligible, but that probably has more to do with my inability to speak Japanese the way I should. But one interesting experience was there was one older gentleman. I think he had been a naval warrant officer. He survived. I think the Marines pulled him half dead out of a sort of a bomb crater. But he came by the embassy to meet us, and I was the Marine guy there, so I dressed up in my the alphas, the green uniform,
right,
to put on a good appearance. And when he came to the door, I opened the door and to the attaché's office, and when he looked at me, and he was this little old man, and he looked as if he had just seen a ghost. And he actually, he held out his hand and he tugged at the uniform sleeve as if he wanted to make sure that it was like a human. And it was one of those interesting experiences that I've had. And I think that thing, just the whole Iwo Jima thing, as it would for anyone, made a huge impression on him. He lived to tell about it, was as lucky as you can possibly be. But see, being face-to-face with a Marine, and this could be the first time he had experienced that in 60 years, it shocked him. And then another thing is I actually went twice to Iwo Jima, once with as a Marine, as the Marine representative with a group of survivors of the the surviving relatives of guys who were killed in the battle.
Right.
And one of the fellows who was there was the grandson of the guy who was
Kiribati.
The Baron. He was in the movie.
Yeah, Nishi, the tanker.
Yeah.
And equestrian, the guy in the Olympics.
Yeah, that's right. It was his grandson or great grandson, a young fellow. Was there, but the irony of it all, to have a Marine on Okinawa with the bereaved families at their ceremony, and there was the Army attaché was there as well, who's a great guy who grew up in Japan. To have us there was once again the irony. I'm a liberal arts major, so I appreciated it, but also at the same time. Now, whilst appreciating what these people had suffered, that it really, what really hurts the Japanese was their, a couple things I'll just point out briefly, is that their treatment of helpless people, civilian and military, in that throughout the entire Pacific War, starting with China in the 30s, was so abominable that it really has left the mark of Cain on them. For all of the sort of the stoicism and the toughness of the troops, now, what they did to helpless people, it's just hard for me to overlook, and I grew up with stories of the River Kwai camps.
Right.
So it's ironic that I like Japan, and I spent so much time...
The River Kwai, why did you grow up with stories of that?
My father had been involved in trying to blow up the bridges, another story. But
okay.
So I've sort of known a lot about what the Japanese did to helpless people, but... Boy, talk about fighting like tigers. And General Slim said that everyone talks about fighting to the last man, but the Japanese were the only ones who did it. But the last thing, I know we don't have much time, is that one of the reasons why the veterans got such a really poor treatment when they came back is that they were seen as representative of the militarists who caused such misery to so many Japanese and the civilian population in particular, that they were seen as representatives of that. And, you know, it's not unusual to run into families that lost three or four people in the war, and then you had the bombing raids of just about every city in Japan that had something to bomb and then bomb it again. That's, I think, one of the reasons why they got treated the way they did. Although one might suggest that they weren't the ones to blame, it was in fact their leaders and also a part of the political class, basically the direct descendants of which the Americans put back in power. But it's part of the dynamic. So it's a really interesting topic, and I'm just surprised to get the question, and it's one I enjoy talking about.
Well, you know, it's I don't know what I was. I want to say that I was researching My Lai in Vietnam, and I don't know how. And I've always been interested in Iwo Jima. To me, it's such a unique battle. And then I crossed paths. General Zinni was coming back from being CO of 9th Marines, and he said, you know, as a professional, you should pick one battle, and you should become an expert in it. You should know everything there is to know about that about that battle. You should know communications, logistics, intelligence, all the different things that happened there, as opposed to knowing a little bit about a lot. And I thought, well, I mean, you know, then I'll pick Iwo Jima. But I had never seen anything like this. And so I was looking on YouTube at stuff, and then I don't know why I typed in Iwo Jima. And or look, if there was ever an Orwellian organization, it is Google, okay? Google is so far up my ass, it's not even funny. I think Google sensed that I was thinking about Iwo Jima, or that just about all the artwork in my studio is about Iwo Jima. And so here's an interview with a survivor. And then when I clicked on one, two others popped up, and I haven't found any more since. But it's amazing the story that they tell about what it was like to live in those caves and fight in those caves. And then I want to say in one of them, he's already the father's passed away, and they go and they tell he was went to school at a French school in Tokyo. And so he didn't believe what he was told about the Americans. And so he was a communicator on Kuribashi's staff. And when Kuribashi went out, and I don't know how he got killed and what they did with his body, but whatever. When that happened, he said, "This is over." And so he went out and said, "I'm going to try to surrender. I'll probably get killed." Well, he gets taken alive. Then they find out he's a communicator. Then they seize on Kuribashi's staff. They fly him to the United States. And there was a POW camp that was built adjacent to the Pentagon. And so you're hearing the story, you're like, what? Adjacent to the Pentagon, and you had these high-value prisoners that they went to with different things and said, hey, tell me about this. And he was one of those guys. And then he learned how to make pancakes in the United States. He goes back to Tokyo after the war. He never mentions the war, except when his daughter said when we would be watching the movie, the TV show Combat, and they would be crawling, but they would be too high, he would start yelling, "No, you will get killed." She said, so I knew my dad was in the war, but I didn't know anything and about what he did. And so the program is them kind of teaching his kids where he went, what he did, and his kids are stunned. And his son says the only thing he ever taught, he was an artist. And he has one sketch, and it's of a Japanese soldier bayoneting a Marine. He said, "I saw this." He never spoke about it, but you can see the detail that he drew with is very vivid. And so I knew my father had demons, and they talk about, you know, his nightmares and things like that. But he opened up a pancake house in Tokyo, and he became very successful. But again, like Vietnam veterans, nobody wanted to hear from them. Right. So can you imagine stuffing Iwo Jima in the Jack in the Box, closing the lid and not going near the hand crank?
Japanese do there can be reserved. So that sort of gammon, that stoicism is part of the game. But yeah, this is why I don't read many novels. Actually, the real stuff so much better.
Oh my God! I'll tell you what—it was absolutely riveting to hear these guys talk about, you know, guys getting blasted in the face by flamethrowers, their skin hanging off, and coming, and then they knew there was nothing they could do, and so they would hand them a hand grenade, and say, hey, you have to go kill yourself. And then one of them, one of them says, this officer comes in and says, okay, this company, you're going to go retake Mount Suribachi. And this is like 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks into the battle. And now they're like in the northern one-third of the island. And everybody looks and says, what did he just say? He just said, we're going to go take Suribachi back. Like, what the hell? Why us? And you just look at this horrible existence, and one talked about eating coal. He said, we didn't have anything else. We didn't have any water. You know, we never saw the sun except through those, you know, through openings that we shot through. And it was amazing because, you know, for years, you know, you lament the fact that, you know, the Japanese culture wasn't more embracing, so that you could read what they went through and read the battle from their perspective. But it was the first time I'd ever seen that, so it was wonderful. I'll have to have you back on, and I would love to get your thoughts on that and talk about that.
Yeah, I like it's an interesting topic. When we were trying to create Japanese amphibious force, you know, I always wondered if there was somewhere a spark of that World War II era savagery we could sort of blow on to get the Japanese to be willing to fight. And it is around. I'd prefer it not be the savagery against helpless people, but these guys fought like tigers. And there's still a spark of it, and it'd be nice to see a little more of it from Japan these days.
All right. Final email. Mac, I saw this question over the weekend, so I figure I would send it in and let Grant have a swing at it. So final question, Grant, is conflict with North Korea imminent? Mike Pompeo was asked that on, I don't know which news program, though. So the director of the CIA was asked that, so you'll be asked the same question. Is conflict with North Korea imminent?
It depends on Kim. I would say that unless he does something like shoot a missile at Guam or, say, even Tokyo, I don't think it is. I just don't think we've got the configured things to do it. I think there's still sanctions. There's a game to be played with the United Nations. There's still more to be done to beg the North Koreans to negotiate. And before, I think, conflict starts, but it could happen quicker. It's up to the North. If they want it to, that's all they've got to do, I think, is fire a missile in a certain place, direction. And I think they'll, and it has to, if it does anything at all that looks as damaging or just too much crosses the line, then I think it'll happen. But otherwise, I don't think we're going to start it anytime too soon. I thought Secretaries Tillerson and Mattis's statement that was released today or yesterday was actually gave a pretty good sense of things, and you can see that the Americans want to give the negotiation, diplomacy, United Nations sanctions approach some time, but they've made it clear that, at least my interpretation of the language is that they're going to give it a try, but they're not going to wait forever. But I would, if I was like going to go on a vacation this fall, I'd probably go without too much fear the war is going to start then. But so a lot depends on Kim.
Kim, he can be unstable, bloviating, blah, blah, in much the worst same way our president is. He just can't. What about bracketing Guam with ICBMs?
That's if he does that, I think that I think America would have to respond. How close is too close? What if it's 300 miles on each side? I think if he does that, that will be if he gets too close, or even does say I'm gonna shoot a missile at Guam. I think he just might have gone too far at that point. But that would be my take on it.
All right, and so I can't let you off the hook. Too far, so we would shoot them out of the sky.
I think we would. I would like to think that the orders have already been given, that if anything comes that way, that it's going to get shot at. Say it did splash into the water, say just off the beach there. At that point, you got a choice, either do something or take it. And if you take it, then it shows you can be bullied
all over the place.
More than you'd like.
Right. All right, sir. Appreciate you staying up late tonight and joining us. Obviously, we'll continue to follow that. And Grant, what I'll do is I'll give you a call and we'll dedicate a couple hours to Iwo Jima. I'm fascinated by the battle, the fact that the island still remains. largely the way it was. I've never been there, and it bothers me because I would love to go there. In fact, my son coincidentally this morning, have you read the book Lions of Iwo Jima about 28th Marine Regiment?
No.
I would recommend it to you. It was written by Fred Haynes. I think he was a first lieutenant captain on Iwo Jima and OPSO S3 guy during the battle, and then rose to the rank of major general. But he tells this incredible story of 5th Marines, the 5th Marine Division organized out of the paramarines and the raiders and things like that, that incredible leadership. Liversidge is a CO of 28th Marines, and it tells their story. One of the stories, though, is one of the corpsmen, for his son's first birthday, buys a lion at the cub at the Los Angeles Zoo for $25 back in the day when you could do stuff like that.
Yeah.
His wife says, get that thing out of here. What are you, crazy? So he takes it to work, and they make the lion their mascot. And they take it to Hawaii when they deploy to Hawaii. And there's these incredible pictures of one of the first sergeants shaving, and he's using the lion's tail to stick into his cup of shaving cream to lather his face. And then they used to march on – they used to have an either afternoon or evening parade where they marched through Hilo in Hawaii. And the lion would march in front. He was on a chain. And the lion would march through with the division band through Hilo. But it's a great book about what he believes is their story of the 28th Marines who took Mount Suribachi in the only fight they've ever been a part of. So anyway, yeah, it's interesting. All right, sir. Again, thank you very much. Appreciate the visit.
Sure. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, there he is, Grant Newsham. He likes baseball, Iwo Jima. Those are all good things. All good things. The awesome. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm not sure the Gunner's going to be with us today. I have not heard. Mike, he's on vacation. Now, do you remember last year when he went to Wisconsin and he sounded like he was on Quaaludes? Yeah. Well, I mean, Red Sox-Yankees played last night. Red Sox won in extra innings. It was awful. And so I think there should be ugly people on TV. Do they all have to be like, you know, they look like models, for God's sakes. The men bug me, right? Especially the younger guys. Come on, man. How much makeup do you have on? Stop it, please. Anyway, so, yeah, the Red Sox-Yankees are playing a great game, by the way, in spite of the outcome. No communication from Mike. So he was dying. I'm following him on kind of like Where's Waldo. So we'll see if we hear from the Gunner today. Until we do, we'll talk news of the day. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on a Monday edition. And again, I got a couple emails about Grant's comments, one about Iwo Jima. So more coming up next on a Monday on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOF community should be aware of.
The Global SOF Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.